Good evening, everybody. Today, I believe, is session number 57. Is that correct? I've got a counter here. And we're going to be starting a new chapter, which is section 4, chapter 6, the order of the day. Do you want to put your MP3 up here, Leslie? Are you good? Is it ready?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're on page 307. Oh, you made it. He braved the storm.
With the balls as well.
Balls
in as well.
Page 307, we're at the order of the day. All right, we're just going to jump in. Now, some of this is a little bit of chazora. Some of it is a bit of revision. Okay, so do you want to share?
Yeah, I'll share it.
Do you mind sharing? Okay.
It's been recorded, yeah.
So page 307.1. We're talking about the power of the forces of impurity during man's time of rest. The highest wisdom ordained that the night should be a time when the forces of evil have the authority to proliferate in all their vehicles and cause their offshoots in the world to move about freely. The intention was that people would remain at home, sleeping and resting until the morning. When the morning comes, authority is taken away from these fortresses and their offshoots. This is again all going back to the Koichos, if you remember, which is in Olam HaKiseh. And the people can once again go...
These forces are Koichos or Malachim?
The forces are rooted in the... Everything is rooted in the Koichos. Says forces, these are koichos, and people can once again go about their occupations at nightfall safely, until nightfall safely. All of this is explained in a psalm. It's actually Psalm 104, which is Kuf Dalet, and in that Pasuk Chof, it says, "You make darkness, and it is night, and all the beasts of the forest creep forth. The sun rises, they slink away. Man then goes forth to his work and to his labor until evening." That's basically the pasuk, which is exactly explaining what we just said earlier. All these concepts, with all their domains and limits, originate in the fundamental roots, i.e. the koichos, the primordial forces, following the various aspects of the influences that affect man at every level. This has already been discussed in section 1, chapter 5.3. Even though nighttime in general is the time when these forces have authority, this is actually only true of the first half of the night. Indeed, when Boaz was sleeping at night and he was accosted, quote unquote, by Ruth, they never had relations, by the way. A lot of people that think they had relations, they never had relations at that time. What she did is approach him, and he didn't know whether she was someone up to good or someone up to bad, but he could feel that it was past midnight. He could sense that it was past Chatzos. Once it was past Chatzos, the forces of negativity do not hold sway. So let's just get this very straight. In the Jewish link of the day, when the sun goes down as Shkia, then you've got a Bein Hashmashos, which is a twilight zone, in between sunset and Seta Kochovim, which is the emergence of three medium-sized stars. After the emergence of three medium-sized stars, all the way through to Halachic midnight, is the time when the forces of evil are ramping up and up and up and up and up. They reach their zenith, their peak, at halachic midnight, known as Chatzos Halayla, literally the half of the night. And then the second after that, there's a ramping down, down, down. They wax and wane, and now they're waning all the way down to Alois HaShachar, which is the breaking of the dawn in the Eastern Hemisphere. Yeah? And that's how the day goes. After Alois HaShachar, then you've got Hanetz HaChomer, which is where the actual sun rises up over the mountains or the tree line in the Eastern Hemisphere. That goes through to Chatzos HaYom, which is midday, then through to Plag HaMincha, etc., and then down back into Shkia. Plag HaMincha is 10 and 3 quarter variable hours from daybreak. All right, so you've got that clear. So we're saying these forces of evil hold sway from Shkia Tzei to Kochovim, depending upon when nightfall really is. We're not really sure. The truth is we don't know. Does night start at Shkia? All those nights start at Seta Kochavim. That is a halachic machlokas, a halachic dispute, for which we have no answer. That's why some Hasidim bring in night later than Ashkenazim. Ashkenazim generally follow the ruling of the Gro, The Gros said, we don't really know. We don't really know whether or not night kicks in at Shkia or it kicks in at Teisa Kochovim. So let's take it from Shkia, because if it's a matter of Shabbos, it becomes Deraisa. And if Shabbos comes in at night, and really it isn't night yet, then you're breaking Shabbos until night comes in. The Chassidim do not rule like that. They rule like Rabbeinu Tam. And he holds, no, it's nothing. It's a process. Shkia just begins a process. It's quite a period of time in New York. It's a 90-minute process, etc. And therefore, night isn't in until three, which means they'll be driving around after Shkia. You know, I'm coming home, you know, from Shul on Shabbos, and I'm seeing Chassidim like driving around. I'm in Shabbos. They're driving around. But then it's the middle of the afternoon. Nothing's happening yet. I'm in Shabbos. They're like, that's all right, you know. I remember, it's anecdotal. I once was in London, and I had my Shabbos belt in my pocket. There was no Erev that was set up. And I had a Shabbos belt in my pocket. And I did a very silly thing. I stopped out of fear. I shouldn't have stopped. But I stopped out of fear. I'm carrying my Shabbos belt. So I just stood there. I was on the drive, the corner of the drive on Woodville Avenue. If anyone listening knows where that is. And I didn't know what to do when people were walking by me going, what's going on? I said, I've got something in my pocket. So someone just knocked on a Hasidic door. And a Hasidic guy came out. He was on the phone. He was on the phone and he had his tzitzis on his outside. T-shirt and tzitzis. A pair of trousers and slippers. Okay? And I was like fully, I was kitted out. I was coming back from shul, you understand? I was coming back from shul. So he walked straight up to me. He was on the phone. He just looked at me. He saw the predicament I was in. He put his hand in my raincoat pocket, took out my Shabbos belt, looked me square in the eye and said, thank God for Hasidim. Turned around and walked off. I never met him before. Mighty Shabbos, had to go back, knock on his door, get my key back. But see, they really hold that it's later, right? Night comes in later. So when does night come in? Truthfully, we do not know. What we do know is that night peaks at Chatzos HaLaila, which we know exactly, and then wanes all the way through to Alot HaShachar. It's at that time that these forces of evil proliferate and magnify. After Chatzos, it's overs for them. They're already packing up and they're going home.
Which I understand the difference between Jewish midnight and ordinary midnight. If you can work that out, surely you know you must be able to work out what the start and the end of midnight.
Yes, it isn't like that though, because we don't know when night actually starts. We don't know if night is starting at sundown or if night starts at the emergence of the stars. So it isn't about. We know again. Let me just make this patently clear. We know all the calculations perfectly as to when the sun is down. And we know the calculations perfectly as to when the stars emerge. Indeed, today, we do not use the natural signs of stars emerging anymore. We actually use calculations. We're forbidden from using natural signs because we've lost touch with a lot of the natural signs, so we only use calculations. There's no doubt we've got the calculations correct. The kasher is which of those calculations do we actually hold by? We don't know. We don't know whether or not Shki is the kickoff or Teisa Kochovim is the kickoff. That's either which way, though. What I'm talking about is the proliferation of evil maximizes or zeniths and peaks at Chatzos HaLaila. And then they slink away. Now, why is that going on? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants a system where good and evil are generated and rejuvenated and in a good system for man to be able to be in a world which has a mixture of both. He can't just keep it all day and evil just wanes and wanes and wanes and wanes and wanes, because then evil won't present a decent challenge to man. So evil needs to do its job out of the way of man, which is when man is sleeping. And man needs to do his job out of the way of evil, because evil's been backed off because now it's daytime. Yeah? We need that for the ability for man to be able to be in a world which has an arena of free choice. So even though nighttime in general is a time when these forces have authority, this is actually only true the first half of the night. At midnight, the influence of illumination and favour emanates from God to all worlds. And authority is taken away from these forces of evil. Their offshoots are driven away from the places of human habitation. And the spiritual illumination of the day begins to be awakened. This continues until daybreak, until when the appropriate influence is transmitted, renewing all existence. The fact that these forces are given any authority at night and driven away by day was ordained as part and parcel of the natural order of creation. This is in addition to the authority or subjugation of evil that is a result of man's deeds. This is a highlight point. If you have a highlighter or a pencil, this is a key point. Starts with Yois in Hebrew, which is two words in from the end of the line, four lines down. And in English, it is true good and evil are primarily the results of man's deeds. almost everything good and evil is man. There are certain things which HaKadosh Baruch Hu has put into the world which are intrinsically good, and there are certain things which man has put into the world which are intrinsically bad. Yeah? But apart from that, it's mainly the things that we're involved with which is good or bad. Now, we discussed that at length, and the fact that most of the things that we are involved with our lives are parav, and we move those things around, bringing them to good or bad. But most of the good and evil in the world is the result of man's deeds. In order for this arrangement to be possible, however, the highest wisdom determined that the laws of nature contain a framework for the expansion of evil as well as its prevention. To achieve this, the highest wisdom decreed that a portion of the daily cycle be given over to evil, which is what we've just been talking about, where it would have the authority to proliferate, highlight, so that it would be prepared to assimilate the product of man's deeds. Do you remember my analogy with the postman and the bin men? What kind of relationship do you have with your postman? I assume chatty. You'll say hello. See, thank you very much. You never seen him. You've never seen your postman.
I've seen him.
Yeah. Well, you see him. You see him. I think people generally. Hello. How are you? Contrast that with the relationship you have with your bin men. Yeah. Okay. Do you? Are you? Hello. How are you with them as well? So I'm more likely.
I think, without getting caught up in the point of the analogy,
just the idea is that a postman you're going to have more of a relationship with generally than your bin man. The reason for that is because the bin man is involved in something which you have actually decided to make hefka. You've made that ownerless. You don't want it anymore. He's taking away stuff you have discarded. The postman is giving you stuff you need. He's delivering to you. When we discussed demons in section 3, when we talked about what the structure and role of demons are, one of the things we talked about is like they literally mop up the evil man does. It's part and parcel of what they do. They feed off of that kind of thing. They need that. They feed off of it. It nourishes them. So that they're dealing their... It's a municipality service to sweep up the negativity, the spiritual negativity that is the product of man's deeds. He's saying it beautifully here so that it will be prepared to assimilate the product of man's deeds. It needs to... People, as they go through the day, generate evil. They generate spiritual negativity. That spiritual negativity needs to be placed in creation. It can't just be left out as litter in the world. It has to be processed. This processing happens when the forces of evil proliferate. So it literally cleans up the road while you sleep. It was also decreed that there be another portion of the daily cycle when this ability would be taken away from evil, so that it be in a state of weakness where man's deeds cause it to be subjugated. That, of course, is mourning. God therefore set up two concepts, namely spiritual light and spiritual darkness, which were the results of his illumination and the absence respectively. Remember the concept of hot and cold? We've got heat is an energy, and cold is an absence of heat. So too, spiritual light is good, and absence of spiritual light is how we define evil. Closest to Hashem is good, distance from Hashem is bad. The more distance from Hashem there is, the more quote-unquote evil it is. When an act is said to be good or bad, what that means, it channels in more of a Kodesh Baruch Hu or less of a Kodesh Baruch Hu into the system. That's exactly why some mitzvahs are bigger than others. They have more of an effect to bring more of the Shekhinah into the world, the Shekhinah being the divine presence, while bigger Averas versus smaller Averas, that Avera only pushes God out a little bit, or that Avera pushes God out a tremendous amount. That's what we call it, a terrible Avera, it's a really big Avera. It pushes God out a lot, leading to an absence of God. What's the problem with that? An absence of God is immediately going to lead to danger and difficulty and strife in anything that he leaves, as it were. His presence leaves. And indeed, don't think that it's the mitzvah that does the good. The mitzvah catalyzes Hashem's presence. And it's Hashem's presence that in and of itself does the good, as we said earlier. So really, it's Hashem's being there that does the good in the world. Okay. God then divided the daily cycle among them, providing daytime for this light and nighttime for darkness. So spiritual light is paralleled by physical light, and spiritual darkness is paralleled By physical darkness, that does not mean the physical darkness is inherently evil. And it does not mean that turning on a light bulb is inherently good. What we're talking about is the state of the time wherever you are in the world, at that hemisphere, at that particular point in time. If it's bright, then you can know that a Kodesh Baruch Hu has happened to have shifted out the negativity at that particular point in time, and you can see where you're going. And opposite, if it's dark and you can't see where you're going, go to bed. You don't want to be out of that time because the evil of the four evil forces have given more, be given more ability to proliferate at that time. The authority of these forces of evil is then given to them at night, and they are driven away by day. All this is so that they should be prepared to assimilate the product of man's deeds, as discussed earlier. Where it says assimilate, I would even change that or add the words absorb or utilize. So you could read that, all this is so that they should be prepared to absorb, stroke utilize, the product of man's deeds, as discussed earlier. Now, that means, technically, the world is quote-unquote more dangerous at night. Because there's more spiritual... Has anyone ever heard the idea that illnesses get worse at night? If you're not feeling well, it always feels worse at night. Mm. Did you ever grow up with that concept?
That's also in the in Jewish teachings as well.
What are we talking about? Why would negativity proliferate at night? We're saying that night is a time when HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given these forces more authority. They've got to have more authority, because it's their job to go round being involved in the product of man's deeds. That's their job. Their job is to literally sweep it up. That's their job. So they've got to be given an ability to get out off the leash, as it were, get out there and do their role. When light comes up, they're nocturnal, they go back, right? They're not dineural like us, right? They're nocturnal. That's their job. They have to be there. So it's a very important point. When the forces of evil are given authority to proliferate in the world, the spiritual darkness of the world is likewise increased and strengthened. Negativity has to come in from the kaychas into the world. Therefore, even though man may be sound asleep and not any way involved in evil, he's not doing anything, the corruption, here called tumah, that is prevalent in the world at that time spreads over his whole being. Don't jump in the gun. That's exactly right. When you're sleeping, if you're sleeping at night, then if you slept through a night, you are at the whim of the forces of the night. That's how it works, right? Your neshama wasn't as present in your body to protect you from that. The night is more evil intrinsically anyway. And if you sleep through that, you are going to be affected by it. That's just how it works. Like, I don't know, if you're sleeping by the beach, you maybe wake up and it'll be salty taste on your lips, you know? What can you do? There's salt in the sea, you know what I mean? You're just part of it. That's how it works. Therefore, even though man may be sound asleep, the corruption that is prevalent in the world spreads over him. The degree to which it can do so depends on the amount of spiritual darkness that exists in that particular individual's body as a result of his personal materialism and evil urge. Now, if you get a real Rasha who's really into naughty stuff, when he sleeps through the world and his neshama's not with his body as it's disassociated when it sleeps, as we'll learn in section 3, then when the wave of negativity comes on, he's going to be like a magnet for that kind of stuff. Because he has turned himself into a Yetzer Hara magnet. So when Tumah comes his way, he is a big Tumah guy. Notice when Rivka was pregnant with Yaakov and Esav, she would just walk by a base of Odah Zarah. She'd walk by like a church or something. And Esav would be like, let's get out of there. Yeah, he'd blow me up. If she walked by a shul or something like that, nothing would happen. She'd have to go in and sit down. Maybe say something to him. Then Yaakov would want to get out. What do we learn out from that? That the force of negativity in the world is generally stronger than the force of positivity. Because Ace, if you could just walk by and you're very excited, here in a shul, you're a big deal, it's a shul. Go in there, sit down, learn something. Oh, now an hour goes by, you don't even notice it. Look, you see it in your own lives. When you're driving a beautiful cinema with lights, or a theatre with lights glowing at night, and they've got these beautiful lights going around, and there's a name, like, I don't know, whatever it is, like latest thing at night, and all the lights are going around. It's very attractive. You're like looking at, oh, maybe I should park up. But you drive by a base of Medrash, you're like, oh, that's very attractive, maybe I should park up and go in. It isn't like that. It's just, it's not as an attractive thing. But when you go into a base of Medrash, you sit down, something's happening. When you go into the cinema, it's like a cinema, you know what I mean? This is now, when, that's why she didn't know what was going on. She said, if this is so, why is it that I am? If this is so, what's going on with this? It's got a split personality inside my stomach. And Shane for Ava explained to her, no, it's not split, there's two people in there. One is naturally much more coarse and more physical, and one is naturally much more spiritual and much more refined. So that's what's happening. You're reading it as if it's one person. It's not like that. Now, if we get an Asav type person and he sleeps at night, when that wave of negativity, which is natural, completely natural from the clothes that happens at night, it's going to hit him like a proper dose of bricks. But when a Yaakov Avinu type person is sleeping at night, yes, he is affected by it, but it's a much lighter coating. Much lighter coating, because that's who he's made himself into. It makes sense, right? Someone who's very grob becomes more grob. Someone who's not as grob becomes less grob. Yep. They're both affected by it. You can't say, well, I'm not in the world. They're both affected by it. They're both, you know, the Chofetz Chaim, there's a famous story. The Chofetz Chaim used to wake up very, very early in the morning. It was a Rosh Hashiva in Radin. And he had negel vasa by his bed. Negel literally means nail in Yiddish. Vasa means water, literally nail water. Netilas yadayim water in a cup. And it was so cold that the top of the negel vasa cup had frozen over. And it happened so regularly, he kept a small little ice pick next to his bed. So when he wakes up in the morning, he cracks the ice to wash his hands. He was once accosted by the Yetzer Hara first thing in the morning. The Yetzer Hara wakes, you know, wakes up with the Chofetz Chaim, the Rav Yisrael Melech Hagen, and says, look, you're Rosh Hashiva. You're a Godel Hador. You're the greatest of the generation. You're getting up so early. Give yourself an extra half an hour. You're an older man as well. Give yourself some time. Covered for a prince of your stature. The Yetzer Hara wisely just said back to him, you're up early, and you're one of the greatest malachim that there is, right? You're one of the greatest angels in Shemayim. What are you doing up? Don't you want to, like, maybe put on some slippers and, like, have an extra, get your teddy bear? And just, no, you're up. First things first, you know? You're up before me, right? He still had to wash his hands. This is what, such a tzaddik. I don't need to wash my hands. He's got to wash his hands too. But he's going to be far less affected than some ruffian that's going to be affected by it, right? Now, besides this, it's also a part of the general order that when a person sleeps, the higher portion of his soul disassociate. It says here remove. We changed that previously in section 3 as well. It's not remove. If it removes, you die. Rahman al-Islam. It doesn't remove. It disassociates or dislocates. It's not completely severed. It disassociates themselves from him, as discussed in section 3, chapter 1.6. When we talked about dreams, that's where the neshama can interact with the celestial spheres and find data upstairs that could be coming through to a dream to the person in his nefesh bahamas. He therefore experiences a taste of death while he sleeps. And our sages have therefore taught us that sleep is 1/60th of death. Let's just get this 1/60th. You probably heard this 60th idea. If you have a drop of milk in a big pot of thing, then it's 60 times the volume, it's okay. Something. What does 60th mean? Let me give you the idea of 60th. It's concept of shishim. Shishim means boundary of perception. Shabbos is a taste, a ma'ain, almost like a shishim as it were, of Olam Haba. Sleep is a 60th of death. A dream is possibly a 60th of prophecy. You understand what I'm saying? What is the 60th mean? Where you're going to sit there and start dividing up your dream into like 60 parts? And then saying, well, that's the bit. No, we don't sort of cake. You know what I mean? Well, we're talking about like this. When you drop a drop of milk into a big pot of meaty cholent, if there is 60 times the volume of the cholent against the milk and it was stirred in, the whole thing is considered kosher. It's not considered a mixture of basar b'chalav because it's not perceptible. So if you taste it, in fact, there's a whole thing of using a goyish chef in the old days. We don't do that today. But in the times of the Shulchan Aruch, they would get an expert chef, and he would taste it. And he says, I can't taste any milk. We would pass it in the kosher. Today we don't do that, but that is actually brought in the Shulchan Aruch as something what to do. Okay, the Beis Yosef talks about it at length, actually. So we would do that. We'd get an expert chef. Now, the point is that if it's 60th, and you know that it's a 60th, it is kosher. Why? Because the milk is technically undetectable, and therefore not there. Even physically it's there, it's not there. For instance, eating insects, apart from four species of grasshopper, which I believe is the red locust, the yellow locust, the grey spotted locust, and the bald-faced locust, which are the four locusts that we can eat, and indeed Yemenite people do eat them. Apparently they're very nice, deep-fried, they're very nice, taste like chips.
Sugar-coated.
I've heard they're deep-fried. I had a Yemenite roommate in Yeshiva who used to eat them, and he said they were really, really tasty. He never offered me any. I don't want to tell you, it's not my minhag to eat them, but I would have given it a go if I could have done, but I can't, it's not my minhag, what can I do? But yeah, I mean, it's be very bizarre, I can ask a child. I mean, Shulchan Aruch says, I thought you should eat them. But apart from that, insects you can't eat. Now, what about very, very small insects? The truth is, if you cannot see the insect at all, it's fine. You eat it. It's not there. It's like this. We don't say, is it there, isn't it there? It's there, but it's non-detectable. If it's completely non-detectable, then its influence is non-detectable. If you can't see it, you can't perceive it, it's gone. What is 60th of death? 60th means is that it is just about detectable. You understand? It's not really detectable. It's you can't even put it into words, but it's about there. A dream being the 60th of prophecy means it's just about detectable what prophecy would feel like. Shabbos being a 60th of blah, blah, blah. It's just about detectable if you keep a proper Shabbos and you really feel the oneg of Shabbos. It's just on the boundary of what Olam Haba is like. Death, a 60th of that is sleep. Not that it is as severe as death, but it's just detectable. Part of that is we become impure through the sleep process and require purification. Just like death makes something impure. Do you understand? Again, it's nothing as heavy as that, but it's just on that magical boundary line of being a 60th. Whenever you see a 60th of this or a 60th of that you're learning, what it means is the boundary of perception for that particular thing. Right? So if meat in milk is on a 60th, it's boundary perception. If it isn't a 60th, if it's beyond it, it's 59th, we say it is meat and milk. If it's at the 60th, it's the boundary perception, it isn't quite there. You understand what I'm saying? Chomets.
Yeah.
Chomets. Isn't bottle 1 in 1,000?
That's right.
If you get 1,000 liters of milk and one drop of whiskey falls in there, even though nobody will be able to taste it, it's no bottle. Because chometz is special. Chometz is the ultimate symbol of the Yetzer Hara, and that never is nullifiable. That is ever present, and therefore we can never do away with chometz in a mixture. Meat and milk, you can do. Treifas, pig, you can do. Bread, that you can't do. Not for a week a year. Which means for a week a year, the most treif food in the world is bread. Mahadrin bread, made with all the hidurim, is the most treif food on earth 1 week a year for Jews. Better eat pork over Pesach than bread. Out of the two, bread is horrendous to eat on Pesach. Pork is allowed. Look, you're not allowed, just for the tape, you're not allowed to eat pork. However, let's just get this really, really clear. Your rabbi says it's okay to eat pork. I didn't say it's okay. I said if someone puts a gun to your head over Pesach and says, either eat this pork or eat a piece of bread, eat the pork. Avada, it's much, much, much less. One laugh. One love to eat the pork. Okay, it's a bad thing. You've got to do tshuva on that. What can I tell you? So your onus, I don't know what to tell you. But bread on Pesach, it's just a no-no. It can't be undone. Now, this is very, very important. As a result of this absence of the purifying light at night, and as a result, oh, I've got to tell you this, I heard this analogy from Rabbi Benjamin Moshkovitz of in Eretz Yisrael. He's got a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, and he says unbelievable brilliance, brilliant mashal, really great mashal. When someone's dead and you go to a graveyard, their body becomes susceptible to impurity. When you leave a graveyard, you've got to wash your hands. But while someone's alive, you don't have to do that. Listen to the mashal that he gives. I think I may have given this mashal to you already, but I'm going to do it again. It's worth hearing again. It's so good. He runs a yeshiva called Medrash Shmuel, okay, in Shar Chaim in Jerusalem. Beautiful mashal. It says like this. Let's say you get a jar full of honey and you put it out in the garden on a summer's day. You may get a wasp or two in there, but basically it'll remain completely clear. Now get that same jar and empty it out. until I'm a container. Now put that jar out. Be full of wasps. Absolutely chock full of wasps. It was like right to the top, full of wasps. What's going on? If you have a jar of honey and it's completely full to the brim, full of honey, you can't get in. The wasps will drown in it. They can't get anything. There may be a couple on the rim trying to eat, but there'll be none in the jar at all. If you pour out the honey from the jar, there'll be a thin layer of honey on the inside of the cylinder, which will be full of wasps. It's like this. The neshama is a very, that's the end of the moshel. Here's the nimshel. That's the end of the analogy. Here's the point. The neshama, while it's in the body, is an extraordinarily strong light. It's a very powerful machine, the neshama. It terrifies the forces of negativity. It's a very, very, very lofty being. It's higher than the malachim. It's a transcendental being, similar to the koichos. More than the malachim, it's similar to the koichos. The force of negativity just aren't able to do anything with that. If the soul's away, there may be parts of the soul which are stuck to the body because those parts of the body have been doing certain avaras. And they're sticking. That's why it says the dead, when they die, it's like removing a thistle from wool. But when the righteous dies, it's like pulling a hair from milk. Famous Gemara. Yaakov Avinu, when he died, he sloughed his body like we slough our coats. Like a hair from milk. But a rosha, to get that soul out of that body, it's like pulling a bushel, a thistly bushel out of matted wool. It's like you're ripping it apart. When you do, let's say an individual does a particular way with his hands. When the neshama leaves, it leaves bits in the hand. At a dead person, the forces of negativity all pile in and start feeding off those neshama remnants at that body site. That's why graveyards are full of tumor. Because all the neshamas are gone, and what they're leaving is open game for all. It's the honey's being poured out. So much so, tzaddik, when he dies, you don't need to wash your hands. But we don't know who tzaddik is. When you learn this out, so come on, Baba Basraf Nunches Omad Aleph. Baba Basraf 58a, when the Pesach Korban was instituted by Kodesh Baruch Hu, there was a couple of men that were taking Yosef HaTzadik's kever from Eretz Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael for burial in Shechem. And they turned around to Moshe Rabbeinu and says, listen, it's not fair. We're impure. We can't give the Korban Pesach. But it's Yosef. It's Yosef. You can't. What is his name? Yosef HaTzadik. If anyone's a tzaddik in the whole Torah, the only person, by the way, is called HaTzadik is Yosef. Moshe's not Moshe HaTzadik. Yehuda's not Yehuda HaTzadik. Yosef is Yosef HaTzadik. Indeed, when the Red Sea was at Moshe Rabbeinu's threat, they said, Moshe Rabbeinu's threat, the Red Sea, I'm not spitting for you, I'm not spitting for anyone. But when it saw the bones of the righteous Joseph, it went, woo, and it split. That's what we're doing, that's a major shrubber. He said, for him, I'll split. Because he's a tzaddik. If anyone's a tzaddik, it's him. They said, listen, we don't. Maybe we're not impure. Maybe we're not impure. Maybe we can still give the Korban Pesach. Because if we're only involved in the burial of such a proper tzaddik, so we can give the Korban Pesach too. Moshe Rabbeinu says, great question. I'll ask the Kodesh Baruch Hu. One of the few times we literally picked up the hotline straight away, he just said, good question, I'll just call. And again, you just call Hashem. God Hashem, Kodesh Baruch Hu said, right, good question. He did that with Benos Slavchad, the daughters of Slavchad, when they said there's no boys and there's going to be no inheritance, what's going to be? And nobody knew the answer, so they went to Moshe Rabbeinu and said, ah, the answer. Just a minute, I'll make it. He literally hotlined to Kodesh Baruch Hu, new Pesukim come into the Torah. Yes, this happened several times. Now, HaKodesh Baruch Hu said, it doesn't matter. Says you, if Pesach, this is where the Pesach Sheni legislation comes in, the secondary Pesach. If the road is too far or you'll be at the particular time, there'll be a place to show you time to do that. Happen. Okay, you'll find another time to do it. But what do we learn out from that? That if you have to say that even for Yosef at Tzaddik, we have to treat the dead all the same. Because if Yosef even was involved and we had to say, look, you know, the dead, with him, you Tzaddik, I'm not impure because, no. The dead people we just have to treat all the same. It's not for us to say who's a Tzaddik, who isn't a Tzaddik. It's only for Kodesh Baruch Hu to say that. It's only for Kodesh Baruch Hu to say that. So therefore, even when going to a known Tzaddik, still wash your hands afterwards. Because who are you to say? We don't know. Because we assume the forces of negativity are feeding off of something which is left. Now let's bring that back down to a 60th of death, which is sleep. While the neshama's away, the cat will play. So the neshama goes up to Shemayim, as we learn, the dissociator. That means it leaves your body vulnerable, and anyway at night time things are more dangerous. Which means that your body is now infested by a lighter toasting, a lighter frosting of impurity than you would get at death. But it is a frosting nonetheless. Is everyone with me on this? Which is why when you wake up, you've got to do something about it. Really, you should wash your feet as well, but it doesn't work. Because washing the feet won't help. Only the mikveh Erev Shabbos can do that. That's why we're only told to wash our hands.
What are the four malachim doing?
Now, whether they're protecting you or not does not stop you from being in the world at the time. The world is negative at that time. Okay, so now let's where do we get to? Oh, the body is therefore much more open for this corruption to be spread over it. Top of the page. This is the concept of the noxious spirit, the Ruach Ra, that rests on a person's hands when he wakes up in the morning, as our sages teach us. The reason for that it rests on the hands and not everywhere else, like on your nose or something like that, is the result of the limits of the high spirit and determined for it. God said it is still, it's going to leave your body. That's why, by the way, I'll be Kabbalah, it leaves from underneath your fingernails. The force of negativity get into your body in the gap between your fingernail and the pad of the skin. Which is why Jews should try to keep their fingernails relatively well trimmed. It doesn't go over the finger line, because if you wash your hands and your fingernails are long, then you can't get it won't be clean. You'll never be clean. So we always trim our fingernails just enough that we can do that. So we wash our hands, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that it's going to stop onto Meperek Shoresh Kaf Hayad, which is the wrist. That's what all the negativity, when it comes out, will leave like a decay, as it were, a noxious spirit resting up until the wrist, dafka. Why did he say that? To give you an opportunity to get rid of it. He'll take away 99.9%, but he's leaving 0.1% for you to deal with. And we'll learn why that is in a second. By the way, while I'm here, parenthetically, Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av are 2 days where we are not allowed to wash our hands fully. We can only wash up to the knuckle line here and the thumb. Don't ever forget the thumb. Many people I've seen wash their hands like this, and the water goes over there, and they've not cleaned their thumb. Well, they're not allowed to daven, because you're not allowed to daven with Ruach Ra on. You're not allowed to say an Hashem's name or anything like that. So you have to wash your hands up until the knuckle line, and your thumb up until the Thenar eminence, this area as well. So you have to wash your hands and thumb, right? But it doesn't go to the palm or to the wrist. So what's going on? The Vilna Gaon explains, on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, it doesn't go there. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't allow that negativity to go all the way to the wrist, because you can't wash that. So it stops at the knuckle line here. That's actually where it stops on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. The nature of it changes. But generally it goes up until the wrist. What on earth is going on with all this? Let me explain. Do you remember I told you when you do a mitzvah, it's not the mitzvah which does anything to perfect the world. It's you giving a Kodesh Baruch Hu justified reason to be more in the world by doing that mitzvah. And it's when Hashem comes into the world more, that's what fixes things up. Do you remember that? So when Hashem turns up, it's like you press the button in Sellafield on the nuclear power reactor. It's not you that is moving the rods into the heavy water. It's a machine that does it, but you triggered it. When you say, I made the electricity, a guy who works in Sellafield says, I made the electricity. Rather, you did make the electricity. You catalyzed the process to do that. Now, when you wash your hands in the morning, what is happening? What you're doing by washing your hands is purifying your body as much as you can. Because you are a mini microcosm of the universe, as it were, the body is designed like the universe is designed, you're doing your bit to purify yourself. When Hashem sees that you're doing your bit to purify himself, he can now come in and purify the world. You've pressed a button. What you're doing is a mini etcher. All it is a mini etcher. Here's a Jew trying to purify himself. Right, what? That's very good. I'll purify him. And while I'm purifying him, I'm going to purify everything. The Mishnah says regarding feeding the world with Parnassa, Rav Chanina ben Dosa has a cov of carobs, which is not a nice food. Like a pot of carobs, not for that's all I give him the whole day. But while I'm feeding him, I'm going to give panasa to the whole world. Because now I'm busy giving panasa. You should know no one who's buried outside the land of Eretz Yisrael is always fitting for resurrection. How can you have resurrection if you're buried outside the land of Eretz Yisrael? Answer is, Moshe Rabbeinu was buried outside the land of Eretz Yisrael in Har Neva, which we know is in the Transjordan. Now, of all people that have ever lived, there is one man that has to get it. And that's Moshe Rabbeinu. So for Kodesh Baruch Hu, you can't not have Moshe Rabbeinu. I mean, what did he do? You know what I mean? So Moshe Rabbeinu's got to get Tchismes. I mean, right, there's one person we know is going to get. While HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to do Tchismes for someone in Chutz La'aretz, outside the boundary of biblical Eretz Yisrael, why is there? There's lots of other Jews as well. We'll throw them in. I wouldn't do it, but now that I'm doing it for someone else, no, you go. I wouldn't give you any food. You don't deserve any food, but that tzaddik I've got to feed. Him I'll give a drop of food. While I'm doing that, I'm going to give huge, luxurious banquets to Rishayim in China. I don't care. Once the concept of giving food is giving, it's open the door. It's a floodgate. It's a button. Once I've washed my hands and I'm doing my bit to purify myself, then I'll purify the whole world. Based upon the action of a Jew. Don't think, because now I've washed my hands, I have purified the universe. No, you haven't. No, you haven't. What you have done is justify an act of purification by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who will do that justifiably, completely legally justifiably, because you've done your bit, you did a mitzvah. You're doing that kind of act, fine, he'll do that, but he's ginormously infinite. So when he does it, he says, look, my Jews are justifying themselves. That's why we're left with these things to do. That makes sense. The Kodesh Baruch Hu is also purifying the world at morning time for wherever you are in the particular sphere that you're sitting on the world. But it's your activities that bring Hashem more into the world. Hashem's mere presence is what fixes things up. He's the one that does it. It's proximity to Hashem that is the antithesis and the cure for negativity. Negativity cannot exist in his presence. So if he's there more, that's what fixes things up. Why was he there more? Because you washed your hands. So what he does is say, right, it's as if when you washed your hands that you did it. When the guy presses the button in Sellafield and the uranium rod goes in and gets hot and makes steam and makes a turn, it's as if the guy made electricity. Not obviously, it's the atoms.
It's an extension.
Right, it's a catalyzing extension by proxy.
Of the saying that God continues the world for the Shema Yisrael.
Right, of the kids that said the little children who say Shema Yisrael. There's good, pin it on something. But once it's pinned and it's working, then we can say you were involved. You were involved. Now, obviously, you didn't do it, Mamish. He did it. But you kind of were involved. And in his glory, he gives you the kind of payment, as it were, as if you did the whole thing. Not, but we didn't. We know we didn't, right?
Where is just the hand?
That's what we said. The noxious spirit rests upon a person's hands when he wakes up in the morning. The reason it rests on the hand and nowhere else is the result of the limits that the highest wisdom determined for it. According to man's state in this world, this is the appropriate degree that this unclean spirit should affect man, no more and no less. I.e., that's where Kodesh Baruch Hu weighed it up and he said, right, there's a certain amount of man that I want to be covered in the spirit of death, even while he's awake. Up to there and no more. He drew a line, a prescription, like an outstanding engineer, a medical engineer, said, right, this is the amount we can allow, but you've got to wash it off. Don't make a bracha before you wash it off. However, when we get up in the morning, we say moda ani, even while our hands are dirty. Why? To prove. Yeah, we're not saying moda ani lefanecha melecha v'kayam shechasad ben shmosi. It doesn't contain Hashem's name. We're not saying Hashem's name. Nothing can shake you away from the Creator. Even
what are you saying, the King?
Even doesn't matter. Even the spirit of death doesn't sever you from God. That's why it's quite important to say modani before you wash your hands. If you feel as if, oh my gosh, unless I am totally cleaned and prepared for my relationship to the Creator, he doesn't want anything to do with me. That's not true. He wants lots to do with you. And there's nothing you can do to get away from him. So much so you say modani, I acquiesce to you. I gratefully acknowledge that you're giving me my life back. That's great. Thank you for waking me up. I can't start saying Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam yet. But it doesn't mean that I'm now dead to the world until I wash my hands. No, you're a Jew. You want to be very, very close to Hashem. He loves you very, very much. Now get out and purify yourself. Get on with business. That's your job. That's what the Kodesh Baruch Hu is waiting for you to do that. All right, remember Rosenblum? What do you do? I'm a Jew. Remember Prince Charles? What do you do? He asked you, what do you do? What do you do? I'm a Jew. That's what I do. Full-time job. How I pay my bills is something else. Right? It's all kosher. What do you need to know about that? You know what I mean? Mamish, hardcore, amazing. That is, I'm a Jew. That's what I do. I purify myself. That's what I do. I daven. I'm bringing up all as much Kodesh Baruch Hu into the world as possible. That's my job. That's my life task. How I'm a father to myself and my family is something separate. That's part and parcel of the whole thing. Beautiful. Now, the highest wisdom prepared a procedure for man whereby therefore every morning he can strive to elevate himself from his lowly nighttime state. Remember we said in the first section, it's man's ability to purify himself and elevate himself from negativity that is his unique strength. We said that right in section one. What man is a tool to take things which are inherently coarse and materialistic and wood and metal and stuff and use it for Kedusha. Look at this room full of paper, which is trees. And in here, right, is a Sefer Torah, which is run on a cow skin. But look what we do with it. We take the skin of the cow, we take the tree, we utilize it for something to do with Ruchnius. That's man's job, right? So he can elevate himself from his lowly nighttime state and illuminate his spiritual darkness. All of this is included in the regulations that were ordained both in word and deed when man wakes up in the morning. Therefore, point four, the first act is the washing off one's hands. It is the hands that are defiled for reasons that Hashem has delineated and upon which this noxious spirit rests up until the wrist, no further. And it is therefore necessary to purify them and drive away this evil, because that's the thing to do in the world. It's your job to drive away negativity. And that means bringing more Hashem in. What does driving away negativity mean? It means bringing Hashem in. That's what does the driving away. More Hashem means less evil. Don't think, oh, I'm washing the evil away. No. You're bringing Hashem in, and that's what pushes the evil away. God ordained that the noxious spirit should be driven away through proper washing. That means left. The left washes the right washes the left washes the right washes the left, etc. As our sages taught, namely, by one pouring water over his hands three times alternately. Not like for challah, where challah you wash three times individually, one, two, three, versus one, two, three. Yeah?
It's hugely important.
Talia Bas Nechama, Refushlema, and as well, we should also have a Refushlema for Chaya Simcha Bas Janet Jamila and Elisheva Bas Estelaya. Okay, so these noxious spirits must be poured away, as it were, by this particular action. Through this action, man's entire body is purified. What? But I'm only washing my hands. What's going on? I'm not going to mikvah. Just as it was all defiled as a result of the noxious spirit that pervaded on his hands, because man is a microcosm, and therefore this concept also includes rectification of creation as a whole. Through the ritual of washing one's hands, the world is also purified of its nighttime corruption and brought out of its spiritual darkness. Let's see page 71.9. Page 71.9. So page 71.9 is in section 1, Fundamentals, chapter 4, Human Responsibility, point 9, page 71. I've got a note there. I've got quite a few notes on this. What's going on? God granted us a particular means which can bring man close to God more than anything else. This is the study and of his revealed Torah. Drop down through all these acts on the highlight point. You should have this bottom highlighted. Man not only earns excellence and perfection for himself, but he also elevates and perfects the entire fabric of creation. This is particularly true in the case of study of Torah. What is going on? How does this work? What are we talking about? Well, this is what we've just been talking about. It's like this. How is me washing my hands in the morning purifying the entire universe? Well, the answer is, technically, it isn't. But it's enough to justify it. Let me explain. Kadosh Baruch Hu created this whole universe so that he could give of his good to another. I mean, that is like fundamental bedrock. That's why he created the universe, to give of his good to another. But it had to be justifiable and fair, because that creature needed to feel justified without eating the bread of shame and to be justified. Those are two things it needs. It needs not to eat the bread of shame and it needs to be justified. It needs not to eat the bread of shame because that would be a negativity in the way the good is given to it. And it needs to be justified because the more you're justified, the more you mimic God. So God gave this man lots of things to do. One of the things was to wash his hands in the morning. Now, when he washes his hands in the morning, and thereby fulfills a mitzvah, as we've just said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows man to remove the noxious spirit that was upon his body at that time. And he does the rest, as it were. He takes the rest away, but it's for man to wash off his hands. Now, as I said, once Kod is actually involved in the purification system, he'll purify everything. It's not just you, it's everything. But he'll pin it on the trigger that you did that in order to fulfill his will. God holds back and waits to act based upon the innovation of man. When Adam was created and he looked around, he did not see a beautiful paradise. He saw what basically looks like Mars, a completely barren area where all the sprouting, the herbage had sprouted but not yet grown. Kodesh Baruch Hu saying you need to daven for rain. First things first, get to work. The first thing Adam Rishon when he did was get up was daven for Geshem. Then all the things grew. Man is the facilitating catalyst in creation. God prepares everything, gets him ready for it, and then says, right, go do it. When you go do it, then walk before me and be perfect, he told Avraham Avinu. When you go do it, I'll follow suit. I'll do everything. You need to press the buttons. You need to plug in. You need to do your action. Once you do your action, I'll do the rest. That's why he says, if you want to learn Torah, open your mouth. Open your mouth for me, but like open your mouth just like enough for a pin's needle, and I will open it up so that horses and carts will go through. But you've got to actually open your mouth. You've got to say, please, Hashem, help me. I want to learn. I want to be able to do. Help me do the mitzvah. Right, okay. Unbelievable cons of creation will turn. But nothing happens until you flip the switch. All you do is press a button. And huge things can happen. You know what I mean? You know, there's a Goisha covered. A Goisha covered. That when they have a dignitary that they want to honor, one of the things they do is to get them to turn on the lights at Chagga. Blackpool, places like this, London, all the lights in Oxford Circus, and they get a big platform. Oh, it's no big deal, I turn on the lights in my kitchen as well. Such a covered. What's the big deal? So you press the button and now all the lights. What's the big deal? It's just, what, it's one button. What's the covered? Answer is, because you see from the one button press so very much happening that it makes it more of an exciting thing. Right? That one button doesn't just turn on one little light. It turns on, 100,000 little lights everywhere, and it lights up a whole city. But so what? Oh, it's the same action, it's just this. Oh, it's all it is. The answer is, yes, it's all it is when you wash your hands. But that action is so profound because it's the fulfillment of God's will that Hashem responds in kind and makes like a tidal wave happen in the exact same particular thing that you're doing. So if you're purifying, he'll have a tidal wave of purification. If you're sanctifying, you'll have a tidal wave of sanctification. If you're praying for panos, you'll be a tidal wave of panos. But it's got to start from a seeding of human effort, which is why the mitzvahs are so critically important. Related to this is the cleaning of one's body by attending the lavatory. Right? Related to this is by going to the toilet. Going to the toilet and removing waste from your body is a prerequisite for tefillah. You can't daven if you feel as if you need to go to the toilet. It's considered a teiva, an abomination. You can't be standing there bursting for the toilet. You can't. It's not a tefillah. It doesn't work. Why? Because you've got to allow your body to be purified to a certain extent in order to be able to do that. Through all these things, man is purified and prepared to approach his creator. Last point five for tonight. This then is followed by two observances, each of which is included among the 613 commandments of the Torah. These two observances are for men, the tzitzis, which are the tassels on a four-cornered garment, which are only attached to a garment if it has four halachic corners. If there's no four-corner garment, there's no obligation to wear tzitzis whatsoever. Also, the deraisa obligation of wearing tzitzis is only during the day, where you'd be able to tell the difference between a line of tcheles, of blue, versus a line of white, which you can't do at night in ambient light conditions. It's only at night, deraisa, and it's only if you're wearing an arba kanfas, a four-corner garment. However, the beauty and the merit, and the specialness of that mitzvah, is such that we actually try to get four-cornered garments in order to attach tzitzis to them, so that we can have the benefit of the segula, the protectorate and the treasure of that particular mitzvah. But it is not a necessary thing if you don't wear a four-corner garment.
It's a pre-mitzvah. Basically, all you've
got to do is put this on. That's it. Another pre-mitzvah is the growing of a beard. All you have to do is not destroy it. Right? It's doing it anyway. If you put on a mitzvah, if you have an arba canvas on, just the sitters are on it and you're done. Every single second that the sitters are attached to arba canvas, there's a little meter going round of merit. Oh, mezuzah. Same thing as well, by the way. Attach a mezuzah to your front door and it's kosher, let's say. Let's say it's kosher for 7 years before it gets checked, right? There's a little meter going around the shore, 7 years. Every second that you've got a kosher mezuzah on your door, you're fulfilling a mitzvah. You don't think about it. You think, oh, I've got a mezuzah. No, that's an active mitzvah every second. So every single second there's a merit going by of a mitzvah. Right now, you're doing the mitzvah of mezuzah. If you have a kosher mezuzah on your door. You're right now fulfilling the mitzvah of mezuzah. I'm believing every second of your life. Yes, every single second, if you've had a kosher bris milah, it doesn't matter what age you had it. Obviously, it'd be best to have it on the eighth day, but let's say whatever reason you missed it, you had it on your 30th birthday, who cares? Every single second you've got that, that is a mitzvah which surrounds you every moment. That's a David HaMelech went to the bathhouse and he was very, very upset. He said, I've got no mitzvahs. There's no mitzvahs on the door. You can't learn Torah in a bathhouse. You can't think of Torah. There's no svarim in here. I'll make it. But he goes, oh, I've got a bris milah. I'm never away from mitzvahs. Every second of my life, I'm somehow attached to mitzvahs. You can't wear your tefillin in a bathhouse. You had to take those off. I don't know why it didn't say beard. His beard would also be, right? His beard, just, she's been destroyed. I don't know why it didn't say, because it's not in and of itself. That's a negative mitzvah. Don't destroy it. Bris milah is a positive mitzvah. You've got to go do it. That's more choshev. We learned Shara Tshuva in the, the third gate, point nine. I think it's Shah Gimel, Ice Tess, that the Ikka Mitzvah is for positive mitzvahs. So a positive mitzvah is more important than a negative mitzvah. And a bris milah is a positive mitzvah. You've got to go do it. Right? Same concept. That's a sittis. And tefillin. Right? Which are called, are they think in English, phylacteries? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Not that it's in the dictionary. I looked it up in the Oxford Dictionary. I think it's the big one, but not in the regular one. Phylacteries is out of use word. But you know what? I'm going to call them tefillin. Because what does phylactery mean anyway? I'm going to call them tefillin. I think phylactery actually means prayer box. Which is a very, very good translation. Because people don't realise, the one that you put on your head, what's that called?
Rosh.
What? The what, Rosh?
Tefillah
shel Rosh. Tefillah shel Rosh. And the tefillah shel Yad. They're not tefillin, that's plural. One tefillin is called a tefillah. Many people call it tefillin, but what's that tefillin? That's not that tefillin. That's like saying oats, and there's only one oat. There's only one oat. Oat is oat, and it's plural. So it's, so it's tefillah. What does the word tefillah mean? Prayer. The prayer of the arm versus the prayer of the head. Remember last week we discussed what's a mincha? Mincha's really a korban, an offering. And now we supplicate a prayer in its stead. But the act of mincha was the prayer. In the base of Mikdush, kub mincha was mincha. Is mincha done? Yeah, that guy just did that. Oh, so it's done. That's mincha right there. This is a prayer of the arm, a prayer of the head. Together they are prayers. Very, very good, right? So that's for prayer box. I think phylactery means prayer box. That's an excellent translation because they really are prayer boxes. They are prayer boxes. Excellent. Not that the words inside them are prayers. They're statements. The Shema is a statement, as we've learned. It's not a prayer. It's a statement of belief of different stages of levels of reward and punishment. It's not prayer. I'm not praying to Hashem by saying the Shema. I'm stating the statement of belief, as we said. Together, the sittis and the tefillin for a man, with prayer, which is the actual announcing of prayer, complete the daily service. Next time, we will explain their own particular significance of tzitzis, tefillin, and tefillah, and go into the individual roles they play in their own rectification of the daily order. Ladies who are listening to this are going, what about me? What about myself? I don't wish this is all about... Well, I probably wouldn't say like that, because a bloke would be saying that. Maybe a very masculine woman. But the point is that they don't wear tefillin and they wear tzitzis. Honestly, they don't need to. The organs of a woman fulfill the concept of tefillin. The tefillah shel yad that we wear on the arm, which is hidden, by the way, that should be hidden, while the tefillah shel rosh should always be ever present. But the tefillah of the arm should always be covered. So much so, some people have little plastic boxes they put over the top. You've ever seen those? That's to hide. To the tefillah shel yad is private. That's why you either you cover it over with your jacket or your garment, or it has a little cover, like a little plasticky box. The Ari HaKadosh says you should always keep that covered, etc., because it's private. Shulchan Aruch says that's private. The only one that you see is the tefillah shel rosh. That's personal. That's the womb. And the coils on the arm are the umbilicus. It's the umbilical cord. Right? The twisting of the cord. Women have this internally. They've got these concepts internally. Men need to strap these things externally onto their body to get the benefit of what these things can do. Because men are external. Women are internal by nature. Okay? Women also interface more with the external world than the women. When the Malachim came to Avraham Avinu's tent, they wanted to make Sarah more beloved to Avraham Avinu, not that she wasn't beloved already. They said, "Where's Sarah Manu?" She said, "Oh, she's in the tent." Oh, Avraham thought, "Oh, she's in the tent." He thought more of her. She was busy making things happen. She was busy making, she was actually making the challahs, the ugas at that particular time. It was Pesach, were uga, making cakes, which is the word egul, which is round, which is why we have the tradition to have circular matzahs. Because Sarah Imenu made circular matzahs at that time when the Malachim came to visit at that Pesach, which is why we have circular matzahs. The first matzahs that were made by machine were also circular. But the Chassam Sofer ruled they should be banned because the individuals that were making them used cookie cutter presses. You'd have a sheet of dough coming out that have cookie cutter presses stamping out round matzahs. But that leaves like a residue round the edges. And the unscrupulous matzah bakers of the day were shoveling that unused dough back into the hopper and then printing out another sheet, which had been cooking. But that's beyond 18 minutes. And so all of them were chometz. That's why Hasidim will not use machine-baked matzahs. That's the actual reason. Today, that's why basically all matzahs, they're square. Because if they're square, there's no shiloh, will I take the offcuts and chuck it back in the hopper? Today we could make round matzahs easily. We wouldn't make a sheet and press them. Would extrude the dough into a flat mould, press it and bake it, where there'll be absolutely no waste whatsoever. However, because of the gezeirah of the Chassam Sofer, that all matzahs must be square if they're made on a machine, we don't do that. That's why Chassidim today will still not eat machine-baked matzahs. The truth is, though, that if you look from a kashrus ground, you're far more likely to get kosher machine matzahs than you are round flat matzahs, because there's knetch and knepels that can all happen, like koffel, that can happen like a wave or a gull, that can happen where there could be chometz on it, which you don't get on a machine-baked matzah because they're so incredibly uniform. But that's beside the point. How did I get to that? Oh, because of Sarah Imenu making things, and she was inside the tent because women are internal and men are external, and tefillin and tzitzis aren't necessary for women. Wow, that was a long one, right? But we're back. The point is that the concept of tefillin and tzitzis and tefillah, plus after obviously we've washed our hands and gone to the toilet, all prepare man for the concept of bringing down this rectification. These are buttons we can press to allow Kodesh Baruch Hu into the world justifiably. The more he's justifiably present in the world, the more the world is fixed by his presence. That's the key. It's him that's doing it. It's him that's doing it. Please God, we will continue next week on... just a second. On point 6 of section 4, chapter 6, point 6, which will be the concept of tzitzis. Please God, I'll see you then. I think we're doing good for coverage ground. Please God, I'll see you then.